Up next on Flexible Elements, host Per Jorborg interviews Professor Subramanian Rabamurthy. They talk about his groundbreaking work with abstract learning and modular robotic agents from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley, the executive producer of IT Conversations. Today I'm excited to bring you another program from Flexible Elements with Per Jorborg.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's our program from Flexible Elements.
Welcome to the Flexibility Envelope podcast. Today I'm here with Subraman Ramamurthy, and we're at Edinburgh University. And we're going to talk a bit about his use of game theory and the theory from economics and free agents in modular robotics. Could you first tell me, I usually ask people how they got into modular robotics. How did you discover the subject? And
yeah, so I've been interested in robotics for a very long period of time because I was initially trained as a control theorist as an undergrad. And then after a couple of other things, I ended up doing two things at the same time. I used to work in a company called National Instruments, which made test, measurement, automation equipment. And I was in an algorithms team there. Then I was a PhD student studying intelligent robotics. And so in some sense, a lot of my initial interest in modularity started from observing why NI was successful as a company. So the history of NI is that once upon a time, people bought instruments from Hewlett-Packard, which is now Agilent Technologies. And you would buy these massive boxes of instruments. They'd be $50,000, $100,000, maybe $10,000. But there would always be these boxed instruments, neatly packaged. And they would do whatever it is that they wanted them to do. And after a while, you go to one of these labs, let's say in a chemistry department, and they have 30 boxes sitting around all over the lab. They've spent literally $1 million on this. And more or less, if anything went wrong, you would have to go back to Hewlett-Packard and get it fixed. And it was all used in a very old-style way. And NI's big insight, the founders of NI, their insight was that actually a lot of these boxes have components in common. But more importantly, especially in the more experimental scenarios, people don't want the same thing twice. They want to keep changing things. So this entire company was built around the idea of let's have a very diverse and heterogeneous set of modules, and let's have a software layer that somehow brings these things together in a sensible way. Now, this being a company, a lot of the intelligence of how you compose is up to the programmer. So that's what a programmer would do, is they would buy data acquisition boards, these boards, vision boards, motion boards. They would sit, they would put all of this together in the computer and then look at it through a software layer. And then they would say, this is how I want them to plug together. Then as a researcher, I was looking at machine learning and asking, how is it that you can come up with representations for new problems? So how exactly should I describe a problem so that I can find efficient solutions, let's say, for motion synthesis? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the learning work had to do with trying to understand what is the structure of the system that I have been given. And so I used to do both of these things simultaneously. I worked at NI building these kinds of systems. I worked in my PhD thesis trying to come up with learning algorithms for complicated control problems and so on. Mm-hmm. Then when I came here I had a new faculty position, I started thinking, what is the kind of underlying theme that I want to investigate? And it occurred to me that the underlying theme that I'm most interested in about robotics is interaction with an unknown, changing, you know, continually evolving kind of world. So if you're a bipedal walking robot trying to figure out locomotion, then you want to interact at the lowest level of the ground might change, what should I do? Mm-hmm. But the much higher levels, you want to say, you know, my system design itself might keep changing. And what is the right mechanism by which I should interact with these kinds of systems? So this kind of is quite different from the standard model of learning, where we are trying to look at some complicated object, let's say language. And it is a really complicated and deep thing, and you have to learn about it, but it is more or less there for you to sit down and learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the kinds of systems I'm talking about are different because, you know, every 3 hours they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there is some underlying structure, the structure is very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And this calls for a sort of new way of thinking about the models, I believe. And so that then got me into asking, how else could we formulate these models? And I got interested in the idea that maybe the best way to formulate it has already been seen in other areas, such as in economics, where what we are trying to say is that you have lots of different agents that are essentially acting from local information locally in their own interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is the way in which they're brought together in terms of organizational design, as it were, that gives you the global results. And so that's how I got interested in the idea of how can agents learn in the presence of other agents? How can agents learn about the dynamics of multi-agent kind of systems?
Yes, both the system and the environment, the whole system is acting. Yeah, how should the individual make, what kind of decisions should the individual make to contribute to the ending goal tasks?
Yeah. And that also brings up very interesting theoretical questions. So I have a collaboration that we've recently started with a computational complexity theorist in my department,
mm-hmm.
where we're trying to ask, how can you characterize protocols where you have, you know, very weak local information, constraints such as privacy, I don't want to reveal certain kinds of information,
mm-hmm.
and constraints on communication and so on. And how do you compare one protocol for doing this kinds of information processing against another? And there are lots of open foundational scientific questions that come out of thinking in this way, that
mm-hmm.
that every system is really an ad hoc collection of diverse heterogeneous modules.
Yeah, and how do we know that we have improved? If we can't say that this is algorithm one and algorithm two, this one is better because, and this one is not good because. And would that also map to the situation, of course? Say that we have situation A and B.
Yeah.
One algorithm might be good for A and the other one for B.
Exactly.
And how do we match both the algorithm? How do we value the situation and algorithm so that we can match the situation and algorithm, saying that A is better, algorithm one is better for situation A, algorithm two is better for situation B?
Yeah. And actually, this is precisely one of the questions that I'm currently working on with a postdoctoral research associate here, Hassan Mahmoud.
Mm-hmm.
This is called the problem of transfer learning. So I've learned a number of different things,
mm-hmm.
and you put me in a new environment, and mm-hmm. I have to transfer only the bits of information that make sense from my old information
mm-hmm.
Into this new world so that I can act there.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of kind of approaches that people have taken to transfer learning. But a question that I think is still relatively open is how exactly do you talk about the similarity of situations in the abstract sense?
Mm.
So I can say, for instance, that, you know, if I've learned to hit the ball with a tennis racket and then you move me to a slightly different way of playing tennis,
mm.
then I can transfer my skill over for sure.
Yeah.
But then you have... to give you a kind of much more general example, like one tactic that happens in many different places is deception. So mm-hmm. if you're playing robot football
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to say how should you mark,
mm-hmm.
then you have to somehow deceive your marker such that you can run away and take the ball. Maybe mm-hmm. it doesn't happen in robot football yet, but it certainly happens in human football.
Yeah, and it's something we would like to add to robot football, because we've done before we've done that, we're not really playing football.
And then the same thing happens in, let's say, trading agents, where you're trying to say that the way in which you can execute certain kinds of maneuvers is by holding somebody's information state in one place and then doing another thing while that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And at some level, you can say that they're all the same tactic,
mm-hmm.
but in what way? I mean, how do you say mathematically that they are the same tactic?
Yeah, because we talked about the dynamics of the situation. It's constantly changing. But even if, say, during a minute, 1% of the situation has changed, 99% of the situation didn't change during that minute.
Yeah.
And if we could reuse that and focus our discovery or learning abilities on the correct percentage,
yeah.
that would make it would make the problem less daunting, I guess.
Yeah.
Not necessarily simpler, but it would be make it smaller.
Yeah. And so, a kind of question that underlies a lot of this for me right now is essentially this, that when we look at machine learning and kind of algorithmic ways of doing robotics, then we have a set of, you know, formal models of how one should think about decisions. Mm-hmm. And typically, these are very mathematically well-posed, but they're also very difficult in a computational sense in that they are formally intractable in most real-world settings if you just use them naively. Mm-hmm. And then you look around at people, and somehow they can solve all these problems using some, you know, highly specialized trick that may only apply to that problem instance.
Yeah.
But they always have some trick that applies to some problem instance.
Yeah.
And so one of my long-term interests is, what exactly might this person be doing?
Yeah.
And how do you reconcile, you know, the fact that you have proper formal models that are intractable, mm-hmm. and these kinds of ad hoc techniques that people have, mm-hmm. that we don't know how to always fit in into the general framework? And I think that one of the big progresses in robotics will come when we can combine these two things.
Yeah.
And these questions are brought to the fore the most if you have a system that can constantly change, so which is composed of modules where you have other agents that make decisions.
Yeah.
And sometimes this happens even when the robot is not modular. So an example is human-robot interaction. In the long run, we want to have a robot that can kind of fit into the place where you are. So I want to give it to my daughter, and she takes it to her birthday party with friends. Mm-hmm. And you want the robot to fit in. Otherwise, it'll just be viewed as an external thing.
Yeah, but both like interact normally as a human would.
Yeah, but we don't have We really do not understand what that means.
No.
And so we don't have a way of making robots make decisions and act in such a way that they would appear to be, you know, strategically and interactively rich in this setting.
Okay. What you said that how would you characterize the situation we are in now? Are we really far away from a solution, or are we? Have you seen substantial progress? Or
so I think that if we restrict the domain enough, we more or less have initial ideas of how to do these things. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I mean, sensing and robot technology has made massive strides in the past 15 years. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have something like Kinect that would mm-hmm. have been much more expensive and difficult to put up before. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, a lot of computing in your cell phones that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And so you're moving towards a setting in which it's realistically possible for a normal person in their home to own some pieces of a robotic system mm-hmm. that could actually, you know, begin to fit in like how we are talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
But we are still quite far away from actually being able to learn and make decisions in a setting in which the variability is very large.
Yeah, yeah. So we're still building the software or the understanding of the world and the matching between task and problem with two small pieces. So it's too slow and it's hard to solve a large swath of problems and say this robot can do everything you do at home, for instance.
Yeah.
Cooking and cleaning and taking care of pets or whatever.
Yeah. And many of these problems are open and hard for various other reasons. So, I mean, if you're talking about taking care of old people, there are so many, you know, health and safety regulations that I, as a researcher, simply cannot deal with easily. No. So my approach then is to say, let's look at how other scientists make progress. So, in biology, for instance, you might sit down and say, I'll define a test tube problem. I'll study this worm. And this worm captures a sense of the problem that I'm interested in, and I'll study it completely. I'll come up with a proper scientific theory, mm-hmm. and then I will generalize from studying lots of different little organisms to the bigger. Yeah.
I understand theory. You worked with ants, for instance.
I haven't. Some of my colleagues have. So Barbara Webb and people.
Because I know that when we come to modular robotics, studying the social insects are very popular. We know that some people are studying termites for construction and just how they organize, because the capabilities of an ant would be somewhat similar to the capabilities of a unit in modular robotics. It's not very capable on its own, but it's capable of just enough to add to the finished the collective, the ensemble axiom, basically, that you have each individual is just powerful enough to contribute to the whole ensemble.
Yeah. So I'm in a slightly different space in that spectrum. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work in swarm robotics and those kinds of things is based on very large number of modules mm-hmm. of very weak local agents, and mm-hmm. then you're looking at the ensemble dynamics in a kind of societal sense. I'm much more interested in scenarios in which you have a few moderately powerful robots mm-hmm. that are interacting in a much more strategically sophisticated way than the small animals.
Yeah, so the not maybe an ant, but a mouse or something.
Yeah, so for me, a good analogy would be, think about how, let's say, farmers and these kinds of people use their domestic pets. Mm-hmm. So they're not that many things. You know, a cowboy might go out on his horse with a dog, with something else. Mm-hmm. And if you just observe the fluidity of interaction between these people, mm-hmm. there are only five units or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then they're very fluid and they know when to do what and they understand context and all of those things.
Yeah, we've all seen a sheepdog work with a herd. Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing what the farmer can do with the dog that he couldn't do in any other way.
Yeah. So I prefer to work at that end of the spectrum.
What could you say would be the significant difference between the really low end, the ant, the termite, and the dog?
Is the fact that the dog can actually act autonomously, think strategically, and do a lot more things. Which means the way in which you analyze these dynamics become different. So if you have a million modules, you can say, well, this is more like a stochastic differential equation in a study where they mm-hmm. equilibrate. If you have only three modules, then the actual way in which they bargain with each other and they actually interact begins to look somewhat different. Mm-hmm. And then the interaction dynamics are of a different nature and require different tools and different concepts.
Okay. So would you suggest that, in your view, is it appropriate to aim for a slightly smarter module in a modular robotic system or a very, very basic one?
I think smarter, more capable modules and sort of moderate numbers of those.
Okay.
So that's why I begin with, you know, let's think about a Kinect, a cell phone, and now an iRobot kind of module. Those kinds of things which are kind of well-built units, they are self-contained, they know uh-huh. some things, uh-huh. but they also have the ability to, for instance, talk to others through Wi-Fi, process a little bit of information.
How do you think that this trade-off applies to a totally homogeneous system where every unit is the same, and bipart or three-part system where you have a very basic, simple unit like a brick, and then you have a more complicated brick-laying thing. So we could have that. We could have both of them. We could have the termite. And we could have the sheepdog. We could have the sheep and the sheepdog, if the sheep excuse that comparison. Yeah. How do you think the decision of having the slightly more advanced module and the slightly dumber module plays out when we can have both?
No, I think there doesn't have to be a dichotomy. So if I took an example from a somewhat different area, so you have ad hoc networks of phones, let's say, mm-hmm. That are at one level of this description, and then you have much more capable network switches and so on that are at a different level. Mm-hmm. And you often have things that go from, like the Internet of Things is all about, mm-hmm. My toothbrush having an RFID. Mm-hmm. So it's not terribly capable. It's not going to jump out and do things.
It's just capable enough to interact with the more capable unit.
Yeah. And so people do envision, and I would agree with, eventually it's going to look like that.
Mm-hmm. So not fully heterogeneous, but homogeneous, but somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but I would say that probably one of the biggest barriers to this kind of work is that if we are not principled about the way in which we're building up these systems, mm-hmm. there's the danger that we build a set of toys and we don't really understand what they're capable of and why and how, mm-hmm. and so it's kind of important for us to carve out the problem in such a way that each of us is working on something but solving that problem completely. Mm-hmm. And so I prefer to carve out the space in which we are talking about rich interaction in small contained sort of settings, mm-hmm. knowing that I will have somebody else who's providing me with a really flexible let's say, modular piece that I can use.
Yeah.
And also knowing that somebody else is going to make advances such as, you know, much better mechanics in my hands and legs and cameras.
We want to be a part of a system, a community.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. I'm grateful for you participating in the interview. And whenever you have some new results to share, we'll be happy to do it again.
You've been listening to a presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Jobwork.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Cheryl Coe. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Jobwork here on IT Conversations.